All right, so we continue our study of the book of Revelation, looking at it through the lens of the Old Testament, connecting those dots so that we better understand exactly what John, the Revelator, is presenting to us. And we come to the precipice, what I will call the precipice of the writing. We're coming, he's brought us all the way through the whole throne room scene and introduced us to this mighty Lamb that is before us, and now we come to the point in the story where this scroll that has been introduced to us is now finally open, and all of creation inside of the throne room can now visibly see the scroll. And the scroll begins at Revelation chapter 8, verse 7, and goes all the way to the end of the book. Okay, so now they can see where we're ending off. Okay, so they can see beyond that. We're ending off, and they can see everything in front of that, behind that, I should say, and it causes a silence. It causes an awe to happen. And so that's where we are today. And this is a good day. This is a good place for us to take our summer break. Okay, so just announcing to the audience out there in Radio Land, we're going to be taking our break. So we're going to be back again, I think, the third week in July. So this will be the last session you hear from us until that time. And at that time, we'll dive right into all of the judgment, the judgments that come from the seven trumpets and the seven bowls. I mean, that if you're going to have a cliffhanger, that's where we should stop, you know. So that's what we're going to do. But today we're in Revelation chapter 8, the first six verses. And so let me read those verses and we'll jump into our study today. So Revelation chapter 8, beginning in verse 1. When the Lamb opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for half an hour. Then I saw the seven angels who stand before God, and seven trumpets were given to them. And another angel came and stood at the altar of the golden censer, and he was given much incense to offer with the prayers of all the saints on the golden altar before the throne. And the smoke of the incense with the prayers of the saints rose before God from the hand of the angel. Then the angel took the censer and filled it with fire from the altar and threw it on the earth. And there were peals of thunder, rumblings, flashes of lightning, and an earthquake. Now the seven angels who had the seven trumpets prepared to blow them. Praise God for his word. So that's where we're at. We're in the throne room of God still yet. We're looking at everything being unfolded, and it all right now centers on this scroll and those seals that are being broken thereof. And so, you know, the scroll is now open, the seventh seal is broken, and this brings heaven to a standstill. It brings them to a silence. And there's a number of thoughts when it comes to this moment of silence, these 30 minutes of silence. You think about it for a second. You know, heaven, or, you know, the throne room of God is always filled with worship. There's never a time when anybody in the throne room says, oh, you know, we're running out of things to do. What do we do today? No, there's always worship time. There can never be enough worship. And naturally, you know, there's never enough noise. Okay, there's never enough going on. But in this particular case, for 30 whole minutes, that's a long, long time to be silent before God. For 30 minutes, for half an hour, we're going to hear nothing but silence. And so, you know, this brings us to the point where we know that This is mentioned multiple times in the Old Testament, so we're going to kind of dive into what that silence is, what it could be. The book of Zephaniah, you know, I've never heard this from any of my biblical scholar friends. I've never heard it from anybody that I've gone to church with. I've never heard anyone come up to me and say, you know, I've completely wore out the book of Zephaniah. I got to buy another Bible. Never heard that said, not by anybody. But actually, when it comes to end times, when it comes to, you know, this whole scene that we have unfolding before us today, Zephaniah is a very important book to read, to know, to understand. We're going to get there in just a minute, but as you see on the screen, I've got Zephaniah 1:7 as the reference to this whole idea of silence standing before God. There's more to say than that about this silence, and so I just wanted to address some of the scholarship that's out there regarding this silence, and in that light, there's a fellow by the name, a scholar by the name of R.H. Charles, who in 1920 wrote about this, and people have, you know, taken it very seriously and wanted to just present some of these ideas. Why this silence? Well, number one, along with Charles and another scholar named Townstead, the praises of the highest orders of angels are hushed that the prayers of the saints on earth can be heard, okay? And that can eclipse what's going on in the heavenlies. What Charles is presenting here is, you know, he's reading the book of Enoch. He's looking at different types of apocalyptic literature. And he says this: the praises of the highest orders of angels are hushed that the prayers of all the suffering saints on earth may be heard before the throne. In other words, you know, it's important now that, you know, we, as the throne guardians, as the one seated on the throne, it's important that we hear from those who, after these seals have been broken and after the scroll is unrolled, and now we see everything that's going to happen to these earth dwellers, it's time to just listen to them. It's time to just be quiet, be still, and let their tones come into our lives. And so, yeah, without question, the text doesn't actually say that, obviously. Charles proposed this view in 1920, but you can read these kind of apocalyptic statements in the literature of his day. You know, the rabbinic literature of the day, you know, will present something like this. And so, you know, there's one of the ideas of why this silence is happening, you know, here on earth. But Townsend actually goes a little bit further. He prefers this second understanding of silence. Silence is the most striking feature of the Old Testament scene that has the greatest bearing on how best to understand the silence in heaven, he's saying. And he's saying, now let's go to Isaiah 52:14 and 15. And yeah, let's go there real quick and let me read that. And of course, this is the scripture that happens right before Isaiah 53. You know, we understand that as the messianic scripture of the Messiah dying on the cross. But it says this, Isaiah 52:14 and 15. As many were astonished at you, his appearance was so marred beyond human semblance, and his form beyond that of the children of mankind, so shall he sprinkle many nations. Kings shall shut their mouths, okay, because of him. So this is the silence that Townsend is referring to. Just before, you know, we begin to unfold this whole scene of the Messiah dying on the cross. For that which has not been told them, they see, and that which they have not heard, they understand. In other words, people are just getting this understanding of who the Messiah is. And Jesus hasn't died yet. In other words, Isaiah 52 leads into 53, and it takes us through the whole scene of how Jesus is basically, you know, just berated and physically tortured and to the point of death before he even goes on the cross. And then the cross takes him to his death. And then that's what Isaiah chapter 53 is all about. And so, you know, Townsend would say that, you know, this should be considered when we think about the silence in heaven. Think about the fact that a king of the earth, this would shut his mouth as he saw this scene unfold. And without question, I mean, that's something to be considered. Third, you know, the silence signals the eschatological return of the primordial silence. Everything is going to be destroyed and recreated. Now, you know, and a lot of scholarship, you know, says that, look, you know, if we're going to have this between chapter 8, verse 7 and the very last verse of chapter 22, we're seeing recreation again. And so if we're going to start with recreation right here, then we're going to start with a series of just silence, because there was nothing in the beginning when God was hovering over the waters. Well, there's nothing to make noise, you know. There's nothing there, and so, you know, he's saying that without question this is happening, and so it should be considered. Okay, you know, I don't disagree, although, you know, I think that's a bit of a stretch. But then moving on, you know, we see that silence must be maintained in the presence of God, particularly during certain phases of the liturgy. Now, there's no question that the heavenly beings understand liturgy. You know, as we read the Old Testament, we get that picture. Look at Psalm 61. Hear my cry, O God, listen to my prayer. From the end of the earth I call to you when my heart is faint. Lead me to the rock that is higher than I. You know, when we're looking at this psalm, you know, we and the psalmist is crying out, you get this idea that I'm going to be silent before the Lord as you respond to me. And you know, we're crying out for, you know, lead me to the rock that is higher than I, for you have been my refuge, a strong tower against my enemy. Let me dwell in your tent forever. Let me make refuge under your shelter of your wings. And he goes on, you know, just crying out to the Lord and waiting for a response. And you know, you can see through this psalm and actually many other psalms that, you know, this is the fact that moving down that for God alone my soul waits in silence, from him comes my salvation. So you can see that the psalmist is just singing this. It's interesting how the psalms just collapse one on the other in this whole series of Psalm 61, 62, but particularly in Psalm 62:1, for God alone my soul awaits in silence. From him comes my salvation. He alone is my rock and my salvation, my fortress. I shall not be greatly shaken. So, you know, when the psalmist stands before his rock, before his salvation, he is actually speechless. He's in silence, and so, you know, it makes sense that, you know, in this particular frame, this is how all of creation that stands in the throne room fills, Habakkuk 2:20. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silent before him. That is Habakkuk saying, okay, the court's in session. In other words, the Lord's in his holy temple. The Lord's on his throne. The court's in session. Hush up. You know, be quiet. Stand before him this way. And you know, the scripture just goes on and on and on talking about, you know, this silence before the Lord. Oftentimes, both the psalmist and Solomon and some of the other proverbial writers, you know, talk about, you know, what it is to come into the presence of God and be speechless, you know, just to see the things of God, to know what he's going to do. And yet this is the end of the story. You know, this is the creation looking at or the creature looking at creation. And they've been involved in the creation all this time. You think about it, you know, from just our human's perspective. Think about the fact that, you know, you've been around the earth. I mean, certainly none of us have been everywhere on earth. And none of us have had the time to take everything in, all of its beauty, all of its majesty. To think that, you know, to stand before God knowing that he's about to decreate this whole thing, to build it back again, that's an awesome thing. That's a very awesome thought. And that would probably render us fairly silent. But, you know, the last thing, though, that, you know, I want to say about that before we go to Zephaniah, because I think we need to look at Zephaniah. This is, I think it's what propels this idea forward more than any other. The content of the scroll becomes known, and there's an appalled silence of what's about to happen to the world. I don't think that that's a stretch at all. You know, I think that without question, that's something that is on the mind of John the Revelator, and he's understanding that without question, those that are in the throne room are appalled. You know, after all, no matter what, even an angel, you know, they've been involved in this earth for thousands of years. And now it's about to be decreated. And, you know, some of the most interesting things these days are, you know, a lot of the scientists, many people are talking about, you know, just the whole geology of the earth now, you know, with climate and all those kinds of things. And one of the interesting conclusions that many scientists are coming up now is this whole idea of the younger Dryas age, where, you know, the earth itself, every now and then, after so many thousands of years, becomes detached from its core, and it spins slightly, which causes, you know, the earth to stop rotating. The core keeps rotating, but the surface stops, and all of a sudden, now you have 1,000-mile-per-hour winds that exist for a little bit of time, and of course, all the upheaval that happens when something like that happens, and except for a very few people, you know, the whole earth just gets decreated, and then, you know, all of a sudden, you know, the core and the surface come back into sync again, and, you know, for another 12,000 or 15,000 years, everything's just fine. Now, you know, how much validity there is behind that, that's immaterial. What I'm just making mention of it because, you know, they're looking at this and they're saying, you know, this earth appears like it's been wiped out at one time and it started all over again. And obviously, that does go along with the biblical story. But, you know, the point here is that as the angelic beings are looking, they're seeing, you know, what they're used to being associated with being deconstructed. And certainly that would be, you know, awe-inspiring in a number of ways. And so think about, you know, this silence. Let's read Zephaniah. I'm going to pick up in verse 2 here and end in verse 7. I will utterly sweep away everything from the face of the earth, declares the Lord. Now, this is what is about to happen. This is what John, the Revelator, is about to take us through with all these judgments, with the seven trumpets and the seven bowls. This is what's going to happen. I will utterly sweep away everything from the face of the earth, declares the Lord. I will sweep away man and beast. I will sweep away the birds of the heavens and the fish of the sea and the rubble with the wicked. I will cut off mankind from the face of the earth, declares the Lord. I will stretch out my hand against Judah and against all the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and I will cut off from this place the remnant of Baal and the name of the idolatrous priest along with the priest, those who bow down on the roofs to the host of heaven, those who bow down and swear to the Lord and yet swear by Milcom. Okay, now that's pretty easy to understand, that you can't be duplistic. You have to have one God. And we read last week that he's going to start at the temple in Jerusalem with the priests, and he's going to work out from there all mankind who have been bowing their knee to the Baals. And so this just continues that thought. Those who have turned back from following the Lord, who do not seek the Lord or inquire of him. This is all those who are going to be wiped out. Now, this verse 7 comes and says, be silent before the Lord, for the day of the Lord is near. The Lord has prepared a sacrifice and consecrated his guest. And on the day of the Lord's sacrifice, okay, now listen to what's about to happen. I will punish the officials and the king's sons and all who array themselves in foreign attire, worshiping the foreign gods. On that day, I will punish everyone who leaps over the threshold. This is the threshold is talking about that that we saw with Naaman talking about, you know, taking his king and the Milcom, the giant idol, fell on its face, broke apart. They wouldn't step on the threshold. They hopped over the threshold from that point. This is a reference to that. All those folks, on that day, I will punish everyone who leaps over the threshold and those who fill their master's house with violence and fraud. Okay, so now you can see that without question, Zephaniah makes reference to this being silent before the Lord because these things are about to happen. And there's no question that John has picked up on this. He's pulling it in. And he knows that we understand Zephaniah, although nobody hardly ever goes to the book of Zephaniah these days. But the point is, that's where this silence is coming from, where we're standing before this open scroll. This open scroll now reveals that what God is about to do. All become silent because they now know the story and its completeness. So Revelation chapters 8 through 22 are now available to be read. The scroll is open. All seven seals are open. And that's what the scroll records, what we're going to read from verse 7 of chapter 8 until the end. So all those in heaven have read this story now. They know what's about to happen. Now, remember, the four horsemen are being held back right now, right? They're still being held back. They haven't been released yet. This verse 7 in chapter 8 is going to release the horsemen, and they're going to do their thing, no question. But at this point, you know, they're still being held back. We're still standing before the Lord, and we're still in utter silence because now we know these chapters are being unfolded. Now, as we stand before the scroll and as we look at Revelation chapter 8 through 21, verse 8, we see that there is decreation. There's the descent back into chaos. Okay, that's where we're going in this story. And that's the reason why the silence, you know, we're going to see all of these beautiful places on earth. Think about everything. We're going to see the Eiffel Tower gone. We're going to see the beautiful structures in the major cities of the world gone. We're going to see Mount Everest gone. We're going to see the oceans turned to blood gone. We're going to see all the beauty that we can see naturally on the earth all gone. Back to chaos again. Clear back to chaos again. And of course, you know, that's going to cause anyone to become silent. But from that point on, and this is just a rehearsal for what's about to come, from that point on, once everything is decreated and once it goes back into chaos again, then picking up in Revelation chapter 21, verse 9, all the way to the end of chapter 22, we see the new Eden coming down from heaven, and I just added in, no assembly required. You know, it's complete. You know, we everything that is about to be decreated, you know, for the most part, human hands have constructed. It's interesting when you sit back and you think about, you know, the wonders of the world. You know, wouldn't it have been wonderful to be able to stand in the Hanging Gardens of Babylon? That would have been a pretty amazing sight. But it's gone. No question that, you know, standing at Giza before the pyramids and before the Sphinx and all these amazing sites, as degraded as they are at this point, pretty amazing, you know, to think about that. It's pretty amazing stuff. And then just some of the natural beauty, you know, to stand at the Grand Canyon and just look out. Of course, you know, we wouldn't have the Grand Canyon if it wasn't for the original flood. But, you know, the point is, you know, it's all going to be decreated, and Eden is going to be recreated, no human hands involved. It's going to be given as a gift. Now, again, even this mirrors the Exodus, okay? So you think about the Exodus. What is one of the primary functions of the Exodus? Obviously, it's to bring God's people out from captivity, out from the iron furnace called Egypt, and bring them into a land that they did not build with their own hands. Okay? You're going to be able to just walk in and take in residence. And that's the reason why God said that now, you know, we're going to do this little by little. You know, you're going to come, you be obedient to me, and you're going to come into this land. We're going to do it little by little, and we're going to push out the inhabitants of your houses. They've been the stewards of them. They've been the builders of them, but now they're your houses, and you're going to push them out little by little, and you're going to occupy the land. And you're going to eat grapes that you didn't plant. You're going to eat wheat. You're going to eat bread that you didn't harvest. You're going to live in houses that you didn't drive one single nail into. And this is the picture of what we see in Revelation. You know, when Jesus said that, okay, now in the Gospel of John, Jesus says, now I'm going away now, and where I'm going you cannot follow. Well, Lord, where are you going? You know, and he starts talking about, you know, I'm going to a place to build a place for you, a mansion that has many rooms. If it weren't like that, I would have told you otherwise. And you're going to be able to take up residency there. That you built with your own hands? No, not at all. That you caused to happen in any way? No, not at all. See, this is God's pattern. This is the way God acts and treats his own. You know? And the interesting thing is, does God... So then, Mike, would you say that God doesn't demand participation? Yes, he does. He absolutely demands participation. Participation in what? Worship, in this particular case. You don't need to build, but you need to worship. You need to be righteous. You need to be, you know, you need to be one with me. And when that's the case, then this is prepared for you. So, you know, we're standing before this open scroll, and this is the story that this open scroll gives us. And so I want to propose to you that these are the two reasons why we're standing in silence for these 30 minutes. Number one, to see the decreation. That should shut your mouth. But then number two, to see the gift that's coming down from heaven. Once again, that should shut your mouth. One of the reasons why Nebuchadnezzar had to be silenced for those years is because when he stood on top of the rampart and looked out at his kingdom, he said, "Look what I built." And for that, he was cut off, at least for a time. And so this is the reason why silence is appropriate for me and you as we stand before the Lord in these two particular cases. Now, it's not appropriate, obviously, when it's time to worship. It's not appropriate when it's time to sing about our God, but it is appropriate when God is about to do some major works in our lives where he deconstructs things and then brings them back into order again. We stand in silence. Kent.
Question. Is it related to, you know, it's like we have no right to say anything at that point. I'm just wondering if it's the same kind of thing as, well, who is worthy to open the seals? And nobody answers, nobody says anything. It's like you open up and see what's going to happen. It's like, I ain't saying nothing. I don't know how that's
going to
happen at all.
Yeah, I like the point that Kent is bringing up. The fact that, you know, you have nothing to say about, you know, breaking the seals. You can't break the seals. You know, you have no authority to break the seals. You might as well just keep your mouth shut. And when the seals are broken and you see the story that's laid out before you, you might as well keep your mouth shut. And so... Yeah, so as think about this in your own life, and you know, I think about this oftentimes in my own life. You think about the times when God has deconstructed you. And if you're a human being, this has happened in your life, okay? There's no such thing as not being deconstructed somehow. Number one, just your whole salvation experience, you were deconstructed. You were living a life that was contrary to God. You were living a life where you were the king. And there's no possible way for salvation in that condition. You have to be deconstructed. And in that deconstruction process, you fall silent. And you experience this. You experience that kind of silence. Because why? Well, What is being deconstructed is what I constructed with my might, with my words, with my philosophy, with everything that I am. That's what I built. And God says, this is the Leaning Tower of Pisa. This is something that can't stand. I can't allow this to stand as a monument to you. This I must deconstruct. And in that deconstruction, if you're standing there saying, well, God, no, I wouldn't do it that way. Well, wait, now don't take down that piece. Nothing like that could ever happen. It just couldn't, you know. I mean, if If that were the case, I would think that God would say, well, you know what, I'll just leave you with your leaning house. No, you stand before God silent, and you see it all come down and just become rubble. Back to chaos. Completely back to chaos. And then when God builds you up again and makes you right, and now all of a sudden your tower doesn't lean anymore like the Tower of Pisa, you must stand in silence. This is nothing that I've done. I can't claim anything that God has reconstructed in my life, so I might as well stand here in silence. And this is the picture that this is painting. No reason to squirm, no reason to justify, just awestruck silence in many times in our life is the most powerful worship that we do. And so I believe that this is exactly what we see as the scroll was, the last seal was broken, the scroll was unfolded. This is what we see. And in a microcosm of this, we understand it well because this has happened in our lives. If we are born again, this has happened in our lives. If somehow, you know, my relationship with my wife has been born again, this has happened in my life. You know, I mean, I can't think of two other places that are more profound as we just stand in silence and just take it in. There comes a time when we stop squirming and we stop justifying and we stop complaining and we just stand in awe and silence of what God is doing in our lives. And this is that picture in a much bigger scale than just our puny little lives. But in the mightiest of way, though, as we stand before this and see the awesomeness of it, we also have testimony of that awesomeness and God taking over our lives exactly that same way. You know, that's what this is a picture of. And so, in many ways, as we begin to see the judgments unfold, we also, I think, can worship through those things, because I do know this, in those awesome times where God broke me back down into chaos to build me back up again, you know, I saw God using many of these techniques, many of these, let's call them plagues, come into my life to reconstruct things. And so I want you, as we start, when we pick back up again, as we start and we start looking at, you know, we're going to look at these plagues, we're going to look at these major events that are about to happen through the bowls and the trumpets. We're going to relate them back to Exodus because they match Exodus. But, you know, I can promise you, you're going to be able to look at this and you're going to be able to say, that happened in my life. That happened in my life. And praise God for that. And so one of the things that I want you to see is the glory of the plagues. It's hard sometimes to think about it that way. But it's the glory of what God is doing here. All right, so now, verse 2, interesting verse. Then I saw the seven angels who stand before God. Now, let's stop right there. Well, and then seven trumpets were given to them. So, you know, it wouldn't be fair if somebody didn't have a trumpet, right? So we got seven angels, we got seven trumpets. And so all seven angels, these seven angels that stand before God, you know, they have this project to do. And traditionally, the rabbis think of the seven archangels that are well known in Jewish Second Temple period literature, particularly 1 Enoch chapter 20, verses 1 through 8. As we look at Enoch 1 through 8, chapter 20, 1 through 8, it gives us, you know, the names and the occupation of all of these archangels. Now, you know, this is just an aside. I think this is just kind of fun. It's fun to think of. Are these the archangels that we're talking about here? The Bible doesn't say that. But there are seven of them. And guess what? How many archangels are there? Well, guess what? According to Jewish literature, there's seven. Interesting. And another interesting thing is there's a subset of these seven. There's four of these seven that seem to be more intimate with the Lord than the others. Okay? So sometimes you'll see the list of four, but you know, in its completeness, there's always seven of these guys, and so here they are. again, this is just an aside. I think this is just interesting. It's interesting to think about. This has nothing to do with, you know, what we're particularly talking about as far as these angels standing before the Lord, unless it's these guys. But just think about this for a minute. Okay, so there's Uriel. Okay, he's one of the archangels. And he's the watcher over the world and over Tartarus. Okay, and so basically his job is to kind of just look at the entire interaction between the heavenly and the earthly and under the earth. Okay, so he's looking at all three realms. He's looking at the guys in Tartarus. You know, we understand that from, you know, 1 Peter, that those rebellious angels, you know, are in Tartarus awaiting judgment. Well, he's in charge of all those things. Raphael, he's the watchers of the spirits of men. He watches everything that we do and looks at our heart. Raul takes vengeance on the world of the luminaries. Now, you may say, well, what in the world is that all about? Well, you know, I'm not going to really get into it, you know, because I don't really want to go too far down this rabbit trail. But, you know, the interesting thing about Raul here is that he's looking at these angelic beings called the luminaries. That's who they are, and he is the one who takes vengeance on those who rebel. Michael is he is like set apart from everybody else. He's set over the best part of humankind, and he's set over chaos. Michael is the archangel of Israel. In other words, he is over God's people, all of God's people, you too. Sarakel, this guy has so many names that it's hard to even pin him down. But the point here is he's set over the spirits who sin in the spirit. In other words, he is dealing directly with the demons, and he's dealing directly with a lot of the rogue angels. Gabriel, you know, he even says of himself, he stands in the presence of God. He's over paradise. He's over the cherubim and the seraphim. That's who he is. And then Remiel, whom God sets over all who are resurrected. Okay, so he watches over the resurrected.
Is that a typo? The serpents and cherubim?
It's not. The serpents are the seraphim. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The seraphim, the cherubim, the serpents. As you look in all of literature and as you look all over the earth, it's the throne guardian of the king. He's a serpent. And it's the Nakash in Genesis chapter 3. He's the serpent. And so that's his job. Yeah, it's just interesting, but you know, the point is, you know, here we have, you know, these archangels. They have their different job titles and things that you know they're in charge of. And so these seven angels who stand before God with these seven trumpets given to them, they're the ones that are in charge of basically everything that happens. And you can see that the archangels too are in charge of, you guessed it, everything that happens in creation. So are they one and the same? Possibly, but maybe not. But you know, I'm just thinking that, well, you know, when you're talking to a rabbi or you're talking to someone who's very knowledgeable in Second Temple period literature, and you're talking about this particular scene, they're going to go to these guys. They're going to say, oh, yeah, no, I know exactly who you're talking about and exactly who's going to blow those trumpets and what they represent. And we'll see as we go into the plagues that, well, you know, actually it kind of lines up with the archangels. Sort of does. Again, just something that's very interesting. Now let's take a look at some of the Old Testament links here. There's nothing in the text that leads us to these archangels for sure. However, it does line up with the angels that brought the plagues on Egypt. This what is called the company of destroying angels. Let's look at Psalm 78, verse 49. Now, we've talked about this before, but he let loose on them his burning anger, wrath, indignation, and distress, a company of destroying angels. Now, what is this? Well, this is the whole plagues of Egypt. If we go back just a little bit, I don't want to overburden this, but if we go back to verse 42 in Psalm 78, they did not remember his power, nor the day when he redeemed them from the foe. From which foe, psalmist? When he performed his signs in Egypt and his marvels in the fields of Zoan. He turned the rivers to blood so that they could not drink of the streams. He sent among them swarms of flies, which devoured them, the frogs, which destroyed them. He gave their crops to the destroying locust and the fruit of their labor to the locust. He destroyed their vines with hail and their sycamores with frost. He gave over their cattle to the hail and the flocks to thunderbolts. He let loose on them his burning anger, wrath, indignation, and distress, a company of destroying angels. Okay, so there it is. I mean, that's the description that the psalmist has of what took place in Egypt, those plagues, and what incorporated those plagues into Egypt, a host of destroying angels. And obviously, you know, the academics are going to pull this out and say, well, you know, you can see without question that this in particular lines up with, you know, that thought in Revelation chapter 8, verse 2. All right, so then moving on to verses 3 and 4, this prayer accepted by God. Now, the interesting thing about it is there's another angel came and stood and at the altar of with a golden censer, okay? And he was given much incense to offer with the prayers of all the saints on the golden altar before the throne. And the smoke of the incense with the prayers of the saints rose before God from the hand of the angel. Okay, so there we have the fact that, you know, we've got these prayers of the saints and they're coming up to God and they're smelling, they resemble incense. And as we go to Psalm 141, we see that the psalmist is talking about exactly the same thing in verses 1 and 2. O Lord, I call upon you, hasten to me. Give ear to my voice when I call to you. Let my prayer be counted as incense before you, and the lifting of my hands as the evening sacrifice. And we also know that without question, incense is also related to the sacrifice, especially even on the Day of Atonement. But Numbers 13:18 says the same thing. Numbers 13:18, and see that the what the land is, and whether the people who dwell in it are strong or weak, whether they are few or many. Am I reading the right one? 13:18. Yeah. And whether the land that they dwell in is good or bad, and whether the cities that they dwell in are camps or strongholds. I may have the wrong verse here. Sorry about that. I may have put the wrong verse in here. Yeah, sorry about that. I may have. Okay, well, let's move on. Forget that. Numbers 13:18 is not relevant. Sorry. But okay, so now let's go to Leviticus chapter 16. We've already studied this together. Picking up in verse 11. Aaron shall present the bull as a sin offering for himself, and shall make atonement for himself and for his house, and he shall kill the bull as a sin offering for himself, and he shall take a censer full of coals of fire from the altar, this is the incense altar before the Lord, and two handfuls of sweet incense beaten small, and he shall bring it inside the veil and put the incense on the fire before the Lord, that the cloud of the incense may cover the mercy seat that is over the testimony, so that he does not die. Now, what is this incense doing? Number one, it's protecting him from the kavod, the glory of God, for sure. But it's also there to make the sacrifice what it's supposed to be. And he shall take some of the blood of the bull and sprinkle it with his finger on the front of the mercy seat on the east side, and in front of the mercy seat he shall sprinkle some of the blood with his finger seven times. So he's presenting this, and it's full of incense. Then it goes on, then he shall kill the goat of the sin offering that is for the people, and bring its blood inside the veil, and do with its blood as he did with the blood of the bull, sprinkling over the mercy seat in front of the mercy seat, and he shall make atonement for the holy place because of the uncleanness of the people of Israel and because of their transgression, all their sins. And so he shall do for the tent of meeting, which dwells with them in the midst of their uncleanness. Again, now remember, what is the Day of Atonement all for? This is what it's for. No one may be in the tent of meeting from the time he enters to make atonement in the holy place until he comes out and has made atonement for himself and for his house and for all the assembly of Israel. Then he shall go out to the altar that is before the Lord and make atonement for it, and shall take some of the blood of the bull and some of the blood of the goat and put it on the horns of the altar all around, and he shall sprinkle some of the blood on it with his finger seven times, and cleanse it and consecrate it from the uncleanness of the people of Israel. What's it for? It hits the reset button. It takes sacred space and it gets it back to clean again. That's the point. It takes sacred space and it gets it back to clean again. It hits the reset button. And so when we see that this is what's happening with this incense, this is what's happening with this sacrifice, we understand that this is hitting the reset button again. This is what is taking place in verses 3 and 4. This is how it lines up. You know, this is a time of hitting the reset button. This is a time of breaking everything back down. This is, ladies, you understand what spring cleaning's all about, right? You know, after you've been in the house, and especially all your boys are in there and they stunk the place up, What do you want to do? When the spring comes, you open up all the windows and all the doors and you get everything out that you can and you scrub it down and you scrub down the floors and the walls and everything and put it all back. And why? You're ready to go for another year. You've got everything reset. You've got everything cleaned back up again. This is what's actually happening from Revelation 8, 7 all the way to 22, 21. It's the reset button. It's getting everything clean again. It's getting everything back the way it's supposed to be. And so, you know, this is exactly, you know, these are the hooks back to the Old Testament theme. Exodus plagues were precursors to the deliverance of God's people. Egypt is a major source of chaos in the Old Testament, a major source of chaos in the life of God's people. And judgment hits the reset button again. That's the point. And incense is the sacrifice. The incense is significant in that piece. We saw that in Leviticus, our study of Leviticus. And then to end today, let's take a look at verse 5. Where this judgment begins, we've got peals of thunder, we've got rumblings, we've got flashes of lightning, we've got an earthquake, we've got judgment happenings in the whole rest of the story. We see it again in chapter 11, verse 19. We see it again in chapter 16, verse 18. So we see, you know, this whole idea of divine judgment starting this way. And of course, you know, we go back to the book of Exodus and we understand that, you know, this is how God presented himself in Exodus in chapter 19, you know, particularly verse 16, on the morning of the third day. There were thunders and lightning and thick cloud and mountains, a very loud trumpet blast, so that all the people in the camp trembled. This is God. This is when God shows up, these are the things that happen. And so we see, you know, as God is showing up, we see, you know, this precursor every time something major happens. There's thunder, there's rumblings, there's lightning, there's earthquakes. All of these things are happening all the way through the book of Revelation. Psalm 77, 17. The clouds poured out water, the skies gave forth thunder, your arrows flashed on every side, the crash of your thunder was in the whirlwind, your lightnings lighted up the world, the earth trembled and shook, your ways as through the sea, your path through the great waters, yet your footprints were unseen, you led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. When God is dealing with his people and he's bringing his people home, he's doing the things that God does when he pulls them out of Egypt, when he brings them out of slavery, when they repent and turn back to him. These are the things that happen to the world who's tried to capture them. And so we see that exactly this is how John is seeing things. Let's end up here, Isaiah 29:6. And, you know, in this particular case, we see this siege of Jerusalem. And it says, you will be visited by the Lord of hosts with thunder and with earthquake and great noise and with whirlwind and tempest, the flame of devouring fire. You know, and the multitude of the nations that fight against Ariel, all that fight against her and her stronghold and distress her shall be like a dream, a vision of the night. In other words, when you're coming against Jerusalem like that, God's going to show up like this, and his enemies are going to experience him in all of his wrath. So, in the end, what this means is, God's people, when God shows up like this, get excited. It energizes us. But when it's not God's people, they cower back. They understand that God's wrath is coming. And so, how do we summarize this all up? So, the judgment of God is at hand. The trumpet plagues are coming with reflections of the Egyptian plagues. The world of today is about to be annihilated. You really can't say it without saying it that way. It's going to be annihilated. This is the day of the Lord, but the destruction has a goal. That's the interesting thing. This deconstruction, this decreation has a goal. It's not just decreation for decreation's sake. It's decreation to bring about a new and final Eden. All of God's people come out of the other side in glory together with the Ancient of Days and the Lamb. That's the glory of the book up to this point. That's how the story is set. And that's how we're going to understand God in all of his power and all of his majesty, doing what he does to decreate and recreate, bring back Eden, and put his people firmly back in Eden forever and ever. Amen. That's where we're at. We're at that precipice. We're at the point of deconstruction. And if it weren't for deconstruction, none of us would have a relationship with the Lord. All right, very good. Any questions about that? Well, that's appropriate because, you know, we're in silence, right?
I ain't saying nothing.
Yeah, that's right. I'm not saying anything. We're in silence. All right, so just a reminder, you won't be hearing from us for a while, but the third week in July, we'll be back at it again, and we'll start in Revelation chapter 8, verse 7, and we'll begin to see how God unfolds these plagues on the earth. Very good. We're dismissed.